Hey, and welcome back to the Prepare Podcast. The Prepare Podcast is a Salvation Army podcast where we invite women of faith and in ministry to share their experiences and wisdom to prepare and equip us in our faith, pursuits, and callings. I'm your host, Sarah McCula, and this month's guest is Arise and Shine Women's Conference Workshop Leader, Nicole Lim. This is actually a rebroadcast of episode 10 of the Prepare Podcast. Now, it's episode 30, so unless you've been with us from the beginning or you've binge listened to all our episodes, you might not have heard this one. Let me tell you a little bit about the workshop Nicole will lead. It's titled Ministering with Survivors of Sexual Violence Through Storytelling. Learn how Freely in Hope journeys alongside people who have experienced abuse, trauma, or violence. In the journey from victim to survivor, we will discuss how we can be better listeners and advocates by allowing survivors to reclaim their story with dignity, power, and healing. This workshop will also share the methods of healing that have been integral for Freely in Hope, including the power of storytelling and prayer as a practice of healing. In the Salvation Army, we minister to a lot of hurting individuals, and this type of workshop goes hand in hand with our ministry. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope that you enjoy this episode. Hey, Nicole.
Hey, hey.
Welcome to the Prepare Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Nicole, I'm so glad you could join me today and share with our listeners about yourself and about the things you've been experiencing in the last, oh my gosh, when did we first meet? Or when did I first meet? Because you were like, was it Urbana?
2009.
Whenever it was, I was just like, she's so young and she's accomplished so much already. Aww. Like, why, I should just quit now.
Oh, whatever. Stop. You're embarrassing me.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so that was like
a live podcast.
Live. So that was in like 2009. And I just remember, I remember thinking that you were so ambitious and that God had placed something on your heart that you were going to follow through on, and I just knew nothing was going to get in your way. So why don't, instead of, you know, letting our listeners scratch their head and wonder, like, what, who is this girl? What's she talking about? Why don't you go ahead and share who you are and what is your ministry?
Okay. So my name is Nicole, and I grew up in the Bay Area in California in the Richmond area. And my background is in film production and photography. And that led me to travel in places all over the world where I was able to learn and experience stories of incredible brokenness and trauma. And through that, was confronted with the reality of issues of sexual violence and how that is directly related to lack of education. And so through that, I started a ministry about 6 years ago, shortly after we had met, actually, that equips survivors and advocates to lead in ending the cycle of sexual violence. The ministry is called Freely in Hope, and I've been doing that for the past 6 years and just allowing survivors to lead in their vocation and to find healing from their past trauma and to encourage others through their rewritten stories. And this ministry is based in Kenya with partners in Zambia and South Africa.
So what was your first experience overseas? Where were you? And what was significant about that experience that made you really shift your life towards this ministry?
So my very first experience overseas was in Rome with the Salvation Army, where I was on a gap year. I was 16 years old and living in Rome for 5 months, where I was able to just really kind of delve into issues of poverty in such a beautiful city. I was really just captured by the juxtapositions of the gypsy community and the homeless community and a lot of children who are orphans just running around the streets with, you know, right next to Versace and all of these really high end, you know, shopping malls and just beautiful architecture. So I think I was just really learning about what the juxtapositions of the world look like. And that kind of just carried me to other places with Service Corps, where I went to Chile and Hong Kong, and eventually ended up in Kenya making a film about women who have overcome adversity and are helping their communities. And I was doing that within the context of the Salvation Army as well. And just all of those stories have really stayed with me, and just my work as a photographer too, in trying to highlight highlight those juxtapositions of life, but also to just leverage the dignity that comes out of seemingly broken situations, is what I have tried to do. And so that has really kind of transcended into my ministry with Freely and Hope Now, where in working with survivors of unspeakable trauma, we're able to just leverage and highlight the dignity and the beauty that arises out of those stories.
So did you graduate high school when you were 16? Sorry, I heard all that, but I got caught on the very beginning where you like had a gap year at age 16. I was like, wait a
minute. Yeah. Yes, because I was homeschooled. Ta-da.
Okay.
So if you knew me, you would not know actually that I was homeschooled, because.
Oh, you just jumped right into it. Good job.
It's a secret. Just kidding.
Okay. Well, that is what my next question was, as we, in the Prepare podcast, take a little bit of a different format in our question and answer time, when I want to know, if you knew me, you would know. And is that the one that you want to share, or is there another?
No, that's actually one that you would not know, because it doesn't come out unless it comes out, you know? Like, I'll only bring it up if it's a topic of conversation, because I have a very strong opinion about homeschooling.
Okay. Was that from kindergarten all the way through?
Fourth grade all the way through.
Okay. So I'm sorry, do you say that is the one you want to share, or you have another?
No, it's not, because that's okay, another conversation.
Oh, interesting. Okay, well then what is the one that you'd like to share?
If you knew me, you would know that I love avocados and African fabrics called kitenge and sass.
Sass?
Yeah.
You are one of the sassier people I know.
Oh, thanks. It's my love language.
Okay, well, can you tell me a bit about those three things? Like, with avocado, do you have a favorite way to eat it? The fabric, how do you use it? Do you wear it? Do you hang it on your walls? And the sass, tell me more about where you like seeing the sass.
I like sending the sass. Okay, so avocado is my favorite because you can get it pretty much everywhere. And I found that in outside of America, they are much bigger and much sweeter and just more amazing. And so I just eat that just out of the shell with salt anywhere I am in the world. And I don't know, I just feel like that is something that is always better outside of America's, because in America, each avocado costs like a dollar. I can get one four times the size in Kenya for 40 cents. So it's just a reminder that every time I eat an avocado, I'm just reminded of the world and the differences of an avocado.
And our exorbitant prices.
And our exorbitant prices that might be using slave labor to pick these avocados. And African fabric, I collect it. Every country I go to, I try to buy at least one piece of fabric. And I have a tailor in Nairobi that I will just sketch out some kind of design, and he'll make it for me. And I try to wear a piece of African fabric at least every day, just as a reminder of my work and the people that I serve in Africa. And also just the vibrant colors, I just feel shares a really unique story, kind of based on my mood for the day. I'll wear a different pattern or color to kind of represent what I feel and who I am and the people that I represent.
Awesome. Love that. And tell me about the sass that you
The sassiness. I don't know. That's just like a love language, I guess, you know, whether you're sassy with me or I'm sassy with you. It's kind of like, you know, that's just how we communicate better.
Mm-hmm. I remember riding on a shuttle bus in Orlando with you, and I can't remember the topic, but you like truth told me so hard, and we just were getting to know each other. I cannot remember what it was about, but I can't remember, but I respected you so much. I was like, she just like told it to me. It wasn't like offensive, but it was like, are you asked me a really hard question? it might have been about like a boy I was dating. And I was just like, dang, she just went for it. And I really like that about her. So when I think of you, I do think of like pointed, purposeful questions. Would you describe yourself that way?
Yeah, I'm pretty direct. And I think that can become an issue sometimes. So I'm learning. So that's why I'm like, if I've ever said anything to you that was offensive, I apologize, because I did not have a filter back in 2009.
No, you didn't offend. It was one of those moments where it was like, you know, like your head just like shifts and you look at the other person and you're like, wow, like that's who I'm talking to right now. Like, she's a person that tells the truth.
I know. So like, watch out. No, but it's true. I didn't have a filter back then. I've learned and I've been growing and kind of just trying to discern, you know, when do I speak my mind or speak the truth and when do I not, especially like as a woman, you know, culture is always telling you have to say certain things a certain way. And I've never been that way. And so it's always been like this battle within me, like, okay, when do I tell this person? When do I not? And so I've been learning, you know, as I'm growing older, like when to say things, when not to say things, and saying it in a way that is most helpful and constructive.
Well, I love that part of you, for the record.
Thanks, hon.
Do you know what your number is in Enneagram?
8.
I knew it. I'm an 8 too. I knew it.
That's why we get along.
It's the truth teller in you, for sure. Like, because tell me if you agree, as an 8, I feel like it's a time waster if you just beat around the bush. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like I'm doing you a disservice by not being honest with you about about important and not so important things. And it is that, like, okay, is this beneficial, trying to tame the tongue thing? But do you agree?
Oh, yeah, totally. And I think that's where I, as an 8, have had to learn and practice my integration into the 2 together so that the truth that I'm telling is actually a healing truth rather than, you know, disintegrating into the 5, where the truth I'm telling you is more of a critical aspect. So it's like learning, you know, okay, if we as 8s have this gift of truth telling, how do we use it in the way that's beneficial rather than destructive?
Yeah, it's a battle.
It's a practice. For me,
that's a better way to put it. It's practice. Okay, well,
along the way, I know how it is.
Oh, I've said so many sorries. All right. Well, can you tell me the next, if you knew me, you would know, and go one level deeper?
I feel like talking about being an 8 is like all the way at the deep end.
We already jumped in.
You know,
in
my deepest, darkest sins.
Hey, no. See, that's where 8s get like a bad rap. 8s and 4s, I feel like they get such a bad rap. 8s coming off as super aggressive, and I don't think that's your deep dark secret, and you don't have to share your deep dark secret, but just something that tells us more about you past the telling about the Enneagram 8.
Okay. If you knew me, you would know that I live in two completely different worlds. Half the time I'm in the Bay Area, which is one of the most gorgeous cities and most expensive places in the world to live in. Mm-hmm. And the other half of the time I'm in Nairobi, which is also a very beautiful city, but it could be very hostile at times. And it's a place where 84% of the country identify as Christian, but over 65% of women have experienced violence.
When you live in Nairobi, what's the time length?
It's between 1 to 3 months. And 2 to 3 trips a year.
And what does that look like when you're there? What work are you doing?
So it's a lot of staff development. We recently hired our very first scholar in our programs, which was very exciting just to see that turnover and her story of transformation and healing that has, you know, brought her to this point where now she's the one healing others through our ministry. It's been really exciting. And then we also hired another one of our girls who is the most phenomenal leader I have ever encountered, and she's 21 years old. So a lot of development with them and working with them and developing their leadership and equipping them to lead and to thrive. Then a lot of the work that I do as well is collaborations with other organizations that are also working to end sexual violence. So we work with Salvation Army in Kakamega, Kenya West, where we do trauma healing focus groups with women in prostitution. And we also work with their children so that in hopes that we can help to end the cycle of mother-to-daughter prostitution. So we've taken a couple of their daughters into our scholarship program. We work with other organizations that also rescue child prostitutes within Nairobi slums. We work with different groups that provide art therapy as a form of healing. We work with children who are survivors of defilement. We also work with International Justice Mission, and we receive their survivors as well that have gone through their legal processes and need the next phase of aftercare. So we provide holistic support for them. So a lot of collaboration with these really great nonprofits working in Kenya for the same goal. The other thing I do is, what else? Just a lot of admin work, the stuff that you don't see that ensures that the electricity stays on and that everyone is healthy and holistically healthy in body, mind, and spirit. That's part of my goals as well, to ensure that not only my staff are healthy, but also the leaders in amongst our partnerships are living healthy lives, and the girls within our programs are holistically healthy as well. And myself. Don't forget myself.
That's key as the leader. You know, if yeah. The leader is having a hard time, it's just going to trickle down. So that self-care is crucial. Now, the girls that are in your program, what do you call them? Are they called clients, or how do you refer to them?
Good question. We talk about this a lot, actually. So we do not use the term victim in our community. We use the word survivor. Okay. And this is because we've just really recognized how they talk about themselves. And the way that they talk about themselves is always in a way that really highlights the fact that they are overcomers. And so when they refer to their story, it's always as being a survivor. Eunice, our very first scholar, she said this to me once. She said, "I am no longer a victim, but a survivor, and my dream is to help other women realize the same." Mm-hmm. And I think that's really part of our goal, is that we switch this language from victim mentality to moving into helping them realize that actually they are survivors, mm-hmm. and through that they can be the leaders of the next generation in providing healing and transformation and restoration to communities that have been shattered. So that is why we use the term survivor. Also, because we focus on academics, we are, out of our partnerships, we are the only organization that provides academic support specifically for survivors of sexual violence. And so in our program, we call them scholars. If they're with us. Yeah. So we interchangeably use the word survivors and scholars.
Now, Eunice, what was her daughter's name? It was a daughter, right? Was it Ruth?
It's a son. No, it's a son.
Who am I thinking of? Wasn't there a young lady named Ruth?
You are thinking of Major Guinness, who was a major at the Kabedi Children's Home in Nairobi. And she has she has seven children. Mm-hmm. But one daughter was named Ruth and one daughter was named Gile in the film.
Okay, because, yeah, I met one of them, and it was Ruth, and we were in Kakamega.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So she is the executive assistant to the TCs.
Okay. I was trying to piece it all together. Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. And so why am I confusing Eunice with – was Eunice in the film?
Eunice is in the updated film.
Okay.
Which I believe you've seen, because we changed it. Mm-hmm. Actually, right. It should have been that time that we were in San Diego together. I changed it by then. So,
okay.
Eunice is the young woman in the film who was a survivor, and was going to school for counseling psychology.
Okay.
So now, imagine her, she graduated in October with her bachelor's in counseling psychology, and we just hired her 2 months ago.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm sure there's been a number of trials along the way with developing Freely and Hope. What would you say was one of your greatest trials in developing Freely and Hope?
The greatest.
Well, doesn't have to be the greatest, but maybe a significant one where it was that question mark moment of like, okay, how are we going to keep moving this forward?
Yeah. Is this the other if you knew me question?
No, we're not there yet.
Not there yet? Okay. So then I'll have this transition. The greatest, one of the greatest situations in the development of Freely and Hope was a couple years ago where it seemed like nothing was going right. Even within our community, as much as we try to end sexual violence, there's always issues of sexual violence surrounding us constantly. And there were situations where some recent stories came out of the survivors, even young women that we didn't know were survivors, because we support both survivors and advocates. Basically, any young woman who has been affected by sexual violence and they want to use their educational skills to end sexual violence, those are the people in our program. So we use that also as a preventative form. And so during that time, I was just hearing a lot of the stories of some of our girls who we didn't know were survivors share their stories with us, and their stories were completely mind-blowing and just completely put me in this place that of deep darkness, because I had never heard violence to that level before, and especially violence of that level that I didn't even know about in the 3 years that I had known them. So that was very difficult. We had situations of, oh gosh, just attempted suicides and unwanted abortions and sexual assaults and some of the rapists trying to come back and attack them again, and just perpetrators not being convicted and justice not prevailing, and just issue after issue. And it escalated to the point where I felt that the failures of the world were actually a reflection of my failed leadership. And it put me in this place where I was unable to recognize that there is hope in the world. And if we want to transition to the next question, that's kind of something that I would share, is that if you knew me, that you would know that I was hospitalized in Zambia because I had caught a virus. And what I believe was that the issues that were so just overwhelming and burdensome that I was trying to control on my own made my body shut down to the point where I was susceptible to catching this virus in the slum. And so it put me out for a whole week where I was even throwing up water. And so I was completely dehydrated, finally checked into the hospital and had the IV drip and everything. And took me a month to physically recover. But of course, the emotional and psychological recovery was ongoing, and it still is ongoing. And that's why I think going back to our, you know, conversation about self-care has just been so integral in this work, because the trauma is constant. The issues and the violence are constant. And as much as we try to fight against it in the world, sadly, it continues to happen. And so I've just learned that our role really as leaders is to do what we can, and just to care for the space that we have, care for ourselves, care for our community around us, and just really trust that God is sovereign and that He will turn it around in good time. So I had to go through this really intense season of learning to understand that, and really searching for those semblances of hope in the darkest places of the world. And in finding them and acknowledging them, just really clinging to them and trusting that even though you may not see it at the moment, there certainly is hope for all of us.
Or what would you say that was the biggest lesson or reminder that God had for you during that time? I mean, you did just mention that God is sovereign, so maybe that's the answer. But was there something that you can reflect back on and know that that was God's message for you during that time?
There was a quote that came up during that whole season where I was like in the hospital, completely, just completely not knowing what to do and just wanting to give up and feeling completely hopeless and feeling completely inadequate for this vocation that God had called me to. And I remember, you know, there's this quote that Saint Irenaeus said that the glory of God is a human being fully alive. And Oscar Romero takes it a step further and he says the glory of God is a poor person fully alive. And I just remembered those quotes because it caused me to reflect on my community and seeing how God's glory is evident in their lives every day. And every day I'm a witness to fulfillments of prophecies where God is actually raising up the oppressed to become leaders in our society. And I see that every single day. And so in that moment where I was like bedridden and just completely feeling like I was drained of everything, I had to remember that God's glory is evident in situations of brokenness because my young women in my programs, like they are living full lives and they are living into full lives and they're seeking out healing and they're seeking out redemption and liberation, not only for themselves, but for the community around them. And so the reminders of my community, it's just this weird, juxtaposition again, where it's actually in delving into the brokenness, delving into the darkness, where you are forced to recognize the hope. And through that, you find liberation.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentor and develop these women into leaders and into into who God has in mind for them to be. Who would you say did that for you? Is there someone or a group of people or something that you feel has brought you to the point where you are as a leader?
Yeah, so many. The first would be my grandfather, Lieutenant Colonel Chek Hung Yi, who was the first Chinese-speaking officer in the Salvation Army. And just his life of really fighting for the immigrant community and then going back to communist China has always just really inspired me to continue to live for the people and to work for the people and to fight with the people in oppression. So he's been my model ever since growing up. And then during my time where I was ill and just really struggling with PTSD, my mentors, Chris and Felina Hewerts from the Gravity Center, they encouraged me to go on a 3-month sabbatical. And at first I was very resistant, but eventually when I did it with them, it was very life-giving. And so I really appreciate them for pushing me to go on sabbatical and practice self-care when I didn't recognize that I needed it for myself. And also I have another mentor named Cherapon. She is the Director of Partnerships for World Relief in Cambodia. And she also really encouraged me during that time of just really recognizing that there is hope present and that reminding me and affirming me that if God has called me to this vocation, that he will see me through it. So those are the key people that have been kind of with me in this journey.
So when you are not in Nairobi and you're in the Bay Area, what does life look like when you are stateside?
In the States, I am constantly moving around, hitting up people, speaking. I just finished a 3-week guest teaching pastor gig for a Presbyterian church where I was preaching on Sundays, teaching adult education in the morning, and then doing workshops during the week. And that was a really cool experience because in doing the workshops, I'm able to teach people about how to engage with these really difficult issues in our world and also how to respond. And that's something that I do very frequently with different churches and community groups on teaching them and engaging them in the stories of our world, especially since 1 in 3 women worldwide have been survivors of either sexual or domestic violence, I think it's really important that we, the church, know how to respond to that, understanding that, you know, 1 in 3 of our friends are survivors, 1 in 3 of our church members are survivors. And so with that awareness, we will approach even our language differently, the way that we talk to people, the way that we help people, and the way that we might say, you know, comments or jokes that might be hurtful to our community. So I think in just learning and being educated about it, we can respond in better ways. So a lot of teaching, a lot of speaking and fundraising and partnering with different church groups and community groups that also want to work with us to end sexual violence.
So you stay pretty busy.
I try.
So when you talk about the self-care piece, what does that look like for you? What is taking care of yourself in a purposeful, intentional way look like?
So it's finding those healthy rhythms that we can come back to on the day-to-day. And I've learned while on sabbatical, I learned that Sabbath is not one day out of the week. Actually, it is a way of living and breathing. And so part of that for me has been the practice of a certain contemplative prayer practice called the breath prayer, which is really breathing in prayer constantly. And that helps me to embody Sabbath at all times. That, and also doing things that are just helpful and healthy and uplifting, having boundaries between life and work, and not letting the situations of the world overwhelm me to the point where I'm just completely, you know, in digging myself in a dark hole that's depressed and difficult. But just having those healthy balances that can equip and strengthen me to sustain, that's been really important. And it's a practice, so I'm learning still every day.
Mm-hmm. Well, I heard you mention some of the teaching topics that you do, like, for example, on that 3-week job as a guest preacher, you know, preacher and teacher, you mentioned teaching about practical ways to engage these topics that you lead on. Now, what are there some, obviously that could be a couple days workshops, right?
Mm-hmm.
But could you maybe give a couple of bullet points, and we could even follow up in the show notes about what that might look like or how to fully engage. But can you give some practical ways that our listeners can engage these topics in a responsible, caring way?
Yeah. So, okay. So the different workshops that I do, one is on art and advocacy and how we can use our creative strengths in writing, photography, film, or design to advocate with people in oppression and to use stories that leverage dignity rather than exploit. And so that workshop is about engaging your creative side, using whatever creativity that the Lord has gifted you with to, for the sake of advocacy. Because I feel like those creative gifts are not only for, you know, personal gain or to make something beautiful in the world, but we're actually, through creativity, creating a new culture, creating the kingdom culture, and creating a culture that is counter to the destruction of our world. So in creating beauty, what does that actually look like for the people that are experiencing oppression and violence on a day-to-day basis? And how can we educate other people by creating beauty, by leveraging beauty out of seemingly broken and dark places through the words that we say, through the art that we create? So that's something that I think the church can be better in really encouraging people with creative gifts to use it for the sake of healing and also advocacy with people in oppression. And then in the other workshop that I do is called No Longer Victims, and that's in helping to recognize that people who've experienced trauma are not victims, actually, but they're survivors, and they can be, and they are the leaders of our world. And we have so much to learn from them, actually. So in terms of engaging in issues of sexual violence and engaging in issues of domestic violence that are so prevalent, like I said, 1 in 3 women are survivors of either sexual or domestic violence. And so knowing that, how do we approach that within our church? How do we respond? And I believe the first step to that is by listening to the stories around us, listening to the situations of brokenness around us, and then through that, being educated by what are the concerns of our friends or our community or of the world around us, and how can we leverage our own giftings to respond in a way that is most helpful and beneficial. That could be through financial gifts, or that could be by encouraging someone to see a counselor, or maybe paying for them to see a counselor. You know, there's different ways that I think we can be helpful advocates with people who have experienced trauma to promote healing and justice.
A couple questions about getting started in developing your own ministry. If there are any of our listeners out there that feel like they have a calling or they have a heart for something, what are some suggestions or best practices that you could offer them for getting their ministry started, getting it off the ground, and becoming a leader in their ministry? Do you have any tips or best practices that you could share?
Yeah, so I'm going to talk first about recognizing what your vocational calling might be, and then second, the approach to that. So to recognize what your vocational calling might be, what I have found helpful is recognizing where your passions lie. What is it that you do that gives you the most life? I feel like that is what a passion is. When you're doing it, that you find life and you find joy in doing. And the second is compassion. How do you show compassion to others? And when we look at scripture, we recognize that every time Jesus was with the crowd and he felt compassion for them, he did something about it. And I think that's important for us to remember that compassion doesn't just involve, it involves a listening ear, but it actually goes a step further to actually provide and to do and to help. So how do you show compassion? And then thirdly is people. Who are the people groups or the people types that you are most passionate for and about? For me, it's survivors of sexual violence and advocates against sexual violence. For you, it might be something different. And so I think in recognizing those three, the passion, compassion, and people, and just kind of combining all of those three things together, I think that's how you can find what your vocational calling might be. And my advice would just be to start in it. To, if you're passionate about the homeless, you know, start volunteering in that space. And through that, you will recognize where your passion and compassion lies. The other way could be, you know, start with your passion, and in recognizing that, how can you incorporate different ways that are actually helpful for people in uplifting people and building them up. So it's a journey, you know, and I feel like God is always speaking to you when you're doing those things, because another way to put passions too is, you know, your gifts or your spiritual gifts. And so I feel like if God gave you those gifts, they are meant to be used. They're meant to be exercised and practiced. And in doing that, you're actually serving and loving God, because he's gifted you with this gift. So therefore use it, you know? So I think all those things together, I don't know, can help start, you know, to spark maybe a new vocation within you. Or maybe it's an old vocation that you've put aside because there's no money in it or it was too difficult. But I think in just really recognizing those things and maybe asking yourself, you know, what is it that I do that gives me the most life? How can you do that for the least of these? How can you do that to serve other people? So now the approach.
Well, real fast, can you identified your people group as survivors and advocates of sexual violence, and would you say your passion piece is, what is that? Is that storytelling? And what's your compassion?
Yeah, actually I'd say my passion is storytelling and using stories through words or through images to leverage dignity. And compassion, I do that through listening to, using those stories that I hear, listening to the needs of the community and providing for those needs. And so in listening, listening from these stories, I've learned that the need was education. And so that's why our ministry focuses on educational opportunities for survivors. And of course, it's really formed and developed throughout the years, but I feel that when you're in community and engaging in these stories of brokenness, you will recognize what those needs are and how your specific giftings can align with those needs of the community. So the approach now is something that I think is a little bit more difficult that a lot of people don't see. And I think especially in these missions, trips, terminology or service oriented projects, I mean, Salvation Army, we're very good at service. We're safe to serve, you know, and I think in that, that is one of our strengths, but it can also be a strength where we overlook other community needs. So a challenge that I want to give to the church and also to the Army is to recognize the approach in that the approach needs to be from the ground up, that the approach of serving the community of oppression should eventually lead to allowing the community in oppression to be the leaders. And this is how I see it in the Army, is where maybe men and women in the ARC program are becoming officers and they're rising up in the ranks. Like, that's actually how I see everything within church ministry, is as I truly believe that the people in oppression are actually going to lead us into further freedom, because they teach us about the world that we have no concept of because of their experiences. And so that's why I feel like they are the strongest and most powerful leaders. So in the approach of leadership, I think it's important to recognize that leadership is about giving it away, and to be a great leader, it must be given away to serve others and to help others find their calling, so that from places of oppression, they will be given those platforms to lead into their own fullness. I think that's what true leadership is.
Mm, that's beautiful. There's a lot of amens going through my head, especially through that ARC adult rehabilitation piece.
Yeah, we do that so well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we do that so well. And I feel like if people want the biblical perspective for that, it comes from not only Jesus's ministry and uplifting people in poverty, but it's what Jesus did was a fulfillment of the prophecy in Isaiah 61, where it was a proclamation of Jesus coming to provide freedom and liberation, and freedom from captivity, liberation from sins, and preaching the good news, and allowing the blind to see, all these beautiful things. It then goes into the next phase of that prophecy, where he provides healing and a crown of beauty for ashes, and joy for sorrows. And so he's replacing all of these seemingly broken situations in our lives with reminders of his beauty, reminders of his fullness and transformation. And so that then flows into saying that it is those people that have experienced the oppression, Israel, and also people in oppression today, that are going to be the ones that will restore, rebuild, and renew cities that have been devastated. And so I think that trajectory is really important for us as leaders to remember, is that first, yes, Jesus comes to save and to liberate. We then, it is our mandate to provide liberation for others. In that, we find healing, but also the community of oppression finds healing. And as they're finding healing, the ones who were wounded are being healed, and the healed are the ones to heal the wounded. And so that is the picture of the rebuilding of Israel, restoring, rebuilding, and renewing these places that have been devastated for generations, that I truly believe only people in oppression can be the ones to liberate.
You said building leaders to give, kind of let them go, let them be free. But I think the Army, I don't want this to be a critique, you know, a moment of critiquing, but or I guess in any capacity it can be finding the balance between giving people the freedom to grow into the leader that they are, but not leaving them floundering,
mm-hmm.
like giving them tools to develop and to grow. And that's what I really love about Freely in Hope, is that it's all about intention in that way of giving these survivors the tools to be truly free and to grow into their fullest potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. It's a reminder that we as leaders are here to equip and to continually equip based on the needs of the community, listening to their voices, listening to what it is that they want and need, and providing those resources for them. I think that's very important to know that this journey of spirituality, this journey of leadership, this journey of pastoralship, whatever it may be, doesn't happen in 2 years at seminary or in grad school. It's a continual process. And so just knowing that, that letting our community know actually that, that we're there to walk alongside of them and journey together with them in their development, I think is crucial for really seeing them become the leaders that we hope them to be. And also for them to realize that, they can be the leaders that maybe they never anticipated they would, but that they're actually the most powerful leaders. They just need those platforms to practice it. And like you said, to not be floundering in it, but to be strengthened in it, and for them to find that confidence within themselves that that they're able to see this very different vision for themselves, I think is really crucial.
What do you say, okay, as an eight... I love starting questions with that. As an eight, I know that I find myself to be just a confident person in general, but I know that there were some things in my experience growing up that helped me develop that confidence. And most of those things were actually being rejected from a number of things I pursued, whether it was like a sports team or auditioning for Fiddler on the Roof and not making the chorus line or whatever.
Bad.
But just there's a number of things I recall growing up that I did not receive, but it ended up building my character and building my confidence. Because I think sometimes eights just are pegged as people that are just naturally confident. But for me, I know there was that part of that might be true, but it was certainly some experiences that got me there. Were there any experiences like that for you, or have you always found yourself to be a natural, confident leader?
So I think as an eight, I know the truth about myself that I'm the least confident leader. And especially in the way that I was growing up, I just didn't care. I didn't want to do anything. I was just always angry and bitter. And so it's just been this journey of learning what it looks like to develop more fully into myself, and to just rely on the confidence that only God can give. And I think not being confident is actually a practice of humility. For example, in speaking, so often I always freak out right before, always. Like, there's never a moment where I don't freak out. And, when I first started, I was like, dear God, if this is what I'm supposed to do every day, like, can you at least make it not as terrible? But then what I recognized was that in having the butterflies in the stomach, in feeling super stressed out, it forced me to rely on God's strength through it. And so now it's like, it's just part of the process. It's not, I don't ask for God to take it away anymore, because I know that it's continually to keep me reliant on his strength and not my own. So, yeah. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. It's your response, you know, in your experience. So, yeah, it totally answered my question. Okay, one of the last things I enjoy hearing is if you could share a couple things that you're really into right now that could run the gamut. It could be anything. So, like, for me, one of the things that I'm currently into is my patio and my garden. So it's just the outdoor space is essential and what people in the Midwest live for and gets us through the winters is knowing that they might be able to like sit in a lawn chair at some point.
So
it gets us through. So we've pretty much arrived there out here in the Midwest.
Oh man, that's wonderful.
So that's one of mine. So what would be like three things that you're super into right now?
Oh, okay. So, okay. Food is my other love language in addition to sass. So if you put sass and food together, we're best friends. Burmese food I'm really into these days.
Please describe.
Oh my God. So they have this thing called, it's a tea leaf salad, and it's basically fermented tea leaves mixed with romaine lettuce and peanuts and jalapenos and like all of these wonderful spices And the fermented tea leaves, it sounds weird, but it together with all of these ingredients, oh, and lemon juice, it's like this magical salad that is to die for.
And this is at a restaurant?
Yes, they have Burmese restaurants all up in the Bay Area. So okay. Hint, hint, y'all should come out to the Bay. There's one in Oakland, and there's also two in San Francisco and one in South City. So there's a lot of options that we can go to.
You know all the spots.
I know all of the Burmese restaurants, yes. So you eat that with my other favorite is coconut rice with kombucha squash and pork. Pork is my other favorite food in the whole world. Mm-hmm. Sorry to the vegan people, but I'm Chinese and I have to have my fatty pork.
Yes.
So that stewed together with the coconut rice with the tea leaf salad is this something that I'm really into.
Question, side note, do you ever make these things yourself?
No.
Okay.
And here's another thing about me. Like, I'm alone a lot because I travel so much. Mm-hmm. And when I'm alone, I just don't care to cook all of this stuff for myself. So I just end up eating an avocado and an egg if I'm feeling fancy, which is terrible. But when I have people over or when I entertain or something, like I can cook like a whole spread and that will make me eat meat and eat other things that are good for me. So I'm more of a communal eater. Like if I'm just alone, it'll just kale salad and avocado. So it's kind of pathetic.
Okay. I was wondering if you were like really into takeout, which I totally respect. And that is totally fine. Just curious to know.
No, I'm not into takeout. I have to go out and like have the experience with people or even alone. If I'm traveling alone, I'll go to like any highly recommended restaurant by myself. Cause I feel like that's the experience of the community that I'm in. Then if I have people over at my place, then like that's the experience of community and then I can cook for everyone, but I won't take out normally.
Okay.
And then the other thing I'm into is hiking.
I just went to Colorado. Did you see any of my pictures?
No, I'm going to look at it right now.
You got to look. Tell me more about your love of hiking and then maybe I'll chime in.
So I hate exercising. And so I feel that hiking is a way to exercise, but there's a reward at the top. And I'm all like, as an eight, I'm very goal oriented. And so even though I'm like struggling or I'm hating my life in the process of going up, I know that there will be a plateau and there will be a place where I can see whatever view it is. And I can look down and be like, man, all that hard work for this, totally worth it. So it is in life.
Well, we were in Colorado for vacation a couple weeks ago, and it was, I'd never been to Colorado. I never hiked like that before. And I felt like I was floating at one point. Like it was just such an amazing experience to be in nature that way and to be viewing mountains at that, like it was at my eye level. Mm-hmm. And it was just incredible. I really felt like I was like floating down the mountain. It was amazing.
Ooh, I'm looking at your pictures. So amazing.
All right. Do you have a third thing that you really are into?
Let's see. I talked about food, talked about hiking, music. I love like little young people that are just finding their way on YouTube, but they're so talented and they're unknown. Those are my favorite. So my favorite right now. So I have seasons of favorites, but right now I'm really into this Tongan Australian girl named Fatai, Fatai. She's super talented and she's also a worship leader actually. And really love her work. She just recently came out with an album and she's just really innovative artist and really gifted. And then she has this piano player named David Taufa, who also is an Islander Australian. And then when they vibe together, it's just pure magic. So YouTube her.
All right. Fatai?
Mm-hmm. Fatai.
All right. I have to know. I have to hear this. Okay, Nicole, we've been on the phone for like over an hour. So we can wind down. You have shared a great deal of experience and wealth of knowledge with our listeners. I think that they are going to leave this conversation feeling connected to you and inspired in there. I love the example that you gave of discovering your vocation by recognizing your passion, your compassion, and your people. And that can, was that right? Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Spot on.
And that can really unlock some things that God has in mind for you if you can acknowledge those things, those three things in your life. So,
yeah. And I would like to just put another challenge on that, to err on the side of people who are living in places of oppression. Because I think that's the biblical model that we see throughout Christ's ministry. So it's important to recognize that and remember it and to embody it on a day to day.
And recognizing that that can be right next door.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much, Nicole. This has been awesome. And it's been fun just chatting with you and catching up.
Anytime, girl.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Thank you again, Nicole, for sharing with our listeners about your passion for empowering survivors to bring healing and change to women and the communities they live in. Make sure you are following us on iTunes so you receive notifications for each month's episode. And if you think other women would enjoy the Prepare podcast, write a review for us so women can find our podcast. Also, don't forget to visit www.centralwomenarise.com to sign up for updates for our 2018 Women's Conference. Registration opens March 12th. And if you want a text message reminder to register on March 12th, just text the phrase Arise and Shine to 51555. Again, Arise and Shine all together without any spaces to 51555. Thanks again for listening. See you next episode.